This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of July 3rd, here are a few top stories. Thursday was the final day of the criminal contempt trial for former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports.
Prosecutors painted a portrait of a lawman who flouted federal authority. The sheriff's own words rang out from video screens in the federal court he's accused of disobeying. Quote, "Nobody is higher than me. I don't serve any governor or president." Through video clips, news releases, emails, and records, the government presented its summary of the case to the judge. Arpaio and his command staff were aware of the order to stop immigration patrols and continued to defy it for political gain. To get a conviction, the judge must find the order was clear and definite, known by the defendant, and willfully violated.
None of those elements were shown. Sheriff delegated responsibility to people. The ball was dropped, not on his time, but on theirs, and he never directed anyone to not follow the order.
Defense attorney Dennis Wolinchek spent the majority of his closing argument pointing the finger at another attorney. Wolinchek said former Arpaio attorney Tim Casey is to blame for the sheriff's failure to understand the law. Casey testified earlier in the trial he thought the sheriff understood the order, but the defense claimed the sheriff didn't get the memo. Literally, the sheriff never had email. Outside the courthouse in the beating sun, Tupac Enrique Acosta stood with other protesters. He's been watching the case progress for years and says it's a painful reminder of the long arc of the moral universe.
Which way that arc is going to be bent is going to be determined by the decision by the judge in this case. We expect it to be bent towards justice.
Which for Acosta means a conviction. Judge Bolton gave both sides 2 weeks to submit final briefs. She's expected to issue her ruling shortly after. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And now from KJZZ's The Show, let's talk a famous last name. Here's the show's Steve Goldstein.
Unless you're from southern Arizona, when you hear the last name Ronstadt, you'll automatically think of legendary singer Linda Ronstadt first. And though her artistic impact has been felt internationally, the city of Tucson was associated with the Ronstadt family long before that, as early as the late 19th century, with the Fred Ronstadt Hardware Company. With me to talk more about the Ronstadts is Tucson writer and documentarian Daniel Buckley. Daniel, how important has the Ronstadt family been to building a strong foundation and an infrastructure of sorts in Tucson?
It's almost harder to find areas that the Ronstadt family has not been involved in than those that they have. Everything from politics, public policy, they were ranchers, they were the Ronstadt Hardware Company, which was created by Linda's grandfather, was not just a place where you bought, you know, hammers and nails. It was where the mines bought all their equipment, the farms bought tractors, and people bought windmills. I mean, it was heavy duty stuff. They are the infrastructure of the state, intellectually and physically. And of course, international relations with Mexico, our major trade partner here in southern Arizona, were pioneered by the Ronstadt family.
With all the impact that Fred had starting with the hardware store, was there a feeling that this is just how driven he was, how driven the family was, or did there seem to be a special connection once he came to Tucson that this was the right place for him to do these kinds of things?
He was an extraordinary man, there's no question about it, and he brought with him his father, Frederick Augustus, who had been a mining engineer in Mexico, as well as his brothers Jose, Richard, and his sister Amelia and her husband. And so all of them had very diverse interests. They were all involved in ranching and that sort of thing as well, but each of them found their own particular niche, and their children following them likewise went into extremely diverse things, and they just became the fabric of southern Arizona in so many ways. And you see the physical manifestations of it still in things that they, you know, sought to preserve, institutions that they created. A classic example, the concept of hospice care, which was created by one of Linda's cousins here in a an organization called Casa de la Luz, which has become one of the biggest hospice care companies in southern Arizona.
So, Dan, what happened to the legendary hardware store? What has replaced it?
Gilbert was Linda's dad, and her uncle Edward were the two that ran the store after Fred's death. It had been in decline when the mines were dropping out, when farms were transitioning into becoming, you know, land where people were building homes and so on. There was less demand for that sort of thing. Downtown, people have the idea that the Ronstadt Center downtown, which is our public bus system transit center, is where the Ronstadt hardware store was. And that's not quite true. That was the livery stable of Tucson at one point. But it was an important landmark in downtown Tucson, and it was in that area, and nice that they acknowledged it in that way. The great irony being that now they're talking about tearing it down to use it, you know, as it has become more valuable real estate. But the Ronstadts will forever have a presence in Tucson and will be venerated for all their generations.
How important do you think it is for that legacy to continue as part of Tucson so generations to come can know about it?
Well, it's very important on cultural levels and on physical levels. Honestly, one cannot underestimate the musical impact of the entire family, from Fred creating the first classical music organization west of the Mississippi back in the 1880s, and he and his brother teaching every member of that orchestra how to play their instrument, to, of course, Linda, who is such a profound, impactful person in Tucson, both for her music and for her involvement in politics and social issues and so forth, and other physical manifestations, the San Javier mission and all of the missions north and south of the border, that the Ronstadt family became so involved in the preservation of and trying to keep them maintained as usable churches. Their impact is truly, truly enormous.
Daniel Buckley is a Tucson-based writer and documentarian. We've been talking about the impact of the Ronstadt family on Tucson and on southern Arizona, and you can learn more about them in Arizona Highway's current issue.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Arizona's migrant labor force is growing quickly, and the federal government is determined to target farmers who abuse the rising numbers of guest workers. From the Fronteras desk in Phoenix, KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports that the agency tasked with enforcing labor rules lacks a crucial detail: more agents.
It's watermelon season in the Harquahala Valley, about an hour west of Phoenix. After a day of harvesting, white buses bring migrant workers to the Rio Valley Market. The only store for miles sells anything from spices to underwear. The workers are here on a temporary visa called a H-2A. They still wear sweat-stained clothes from the field, but their mood is light as they buy popsicles, soda, chips, and beer. Marco Raul Medrano is from Guatemala, where he grew corn and beans. He says farm work here is easier because you make more money. While Medrano is here, this store might be his only contact with the outside world. That's because the company he works for gives him food, shelter, and transportation. Experts say this can make H-2A workers vulnerable to abuse. The U.S. Department of Labor has touted a civil lawsuit filed in May against an Arizona farm as part of new efforts to punish bad actors. G Farms is accused of mistreating workers.
We would have been looking at a mass fatality. This housing situation was not even close to safe.
Janet Harold is the Western Regional Solicitor for the Department of Labor, which enforces H-2A rules. In the G-Farms case, Harold says her team took immediate action to help guest workers and punish their employer.
It's a lot of work, and it requires a lot of resources.
After G-Farms, the Labor Secretary called on the entire agency to work with its Office of Inspector General, or OIG, to seek criminal charges against abusive employers. Harold would not say if the investigation into G-Farms is now a criminal case.
OIG is aware of the case. That's all I can really say.
Mike King is an attorney for G-Farms. He says the Labor Department had no reason to bring the civil case.
By the time they filed the lawsuit, the things alleged in the lawsuit had been corrected.
Arizona regulators cited G-Farms for 7 violations. They include overcrowded sleeping areas inside converted school buses, electrical cords near showers, and a water supply that had not been approved.
Doesn't mean anything was wrong with it. It was not inspected first. That's what that means.
All the safety violations only added up to a roughly $2,300 fine from the state, which King says does not match the accusation of inhumane conditions.
I would prefer not to say that the government is making an example of my clients, but you do see it in any range of regulatory matters. There's not enough resources to prosecute everyone.
The Labor Department has to police a lot more farmers than it used to. In Arizona, the number of H-2A workers jumped 156% in 5 years. But there's currently no plan to hire more enforcement agents, leaving more than 5,000 migrant workers in the state vulnerable to exploitation.
They don't have their families here, so they don't have to call in sick.
Amanda Caldwell is the managing attorney for the farm worker unit at Community Legal Services. She says farms see temporary foreign labor as the answer to all of their needs.
They don't have to take the day off to take their kid to school, so they don't have the needs sort of that like other U.S. workers have.
Many workers are afraid they'll be fired if they speak up about wage theft or poor housing.
They can't just leave and walk away and go to a different farm. Their visa is tied to their employer.
Back at the Rio Valley Market, 38-year-old Marco Raul Medrano looks forward to an evening of television and rest. It's his fourth trip to the U.S., and he hopes there will be more. God willing, he says. Medrano gives short answers to my questions. It might be because he's never been interviewed, he doesn't want to miss the bus, or because there are bosses around. I ask if the farm treats him well. Yes, he says, it's good. Medrano has two kids in school in Guatemala. His goal is to help them get ahead, and his H-2A visa gives him until November to earn enough money to make it happen. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, reporting from the Harquahala Valley.
There will be almost 500,000 new jobs in computer science by 2024. Like other STEM fields, there's a dearth of women in the field. But a girl-powered organization, best known for cookies and camping, believes they can open the door to computer science. KJZZ's Mariana Dale reports from Girl Scout Camp.
It's tradition to start the day at Parsons Leadership Center with the raising of the American flag. Then girls from ages 5 to their teens hold up 3 fingers on their right hands and recite the Girl Scout promise. The rest of the day doesn't hold typical camp activities like hiking, horseback riding, or canoeing. It's way too hot at the South Phoenix camp for that. But there is one advantage. The Wi-Fi is great.
Today, what you're going to do is the computer you see sitting on the table there, you're going to actually take that apart and you're going to put it back together.
This is Computer Techie Boot Camp. And for many of the girls, it's the first time they've seen the inside of a computer. Chloe Flood is an exception.
My brother broke a computer by squirting some orange juice on it, so we had to take it apart and put it back together.
After a brief lesson in PC anatomy, the girls pry apart the metal casing and dig into the motherboard.
Try and pull it like this way.
Is it towards me?
How's it going so far?
Good.
Awesome.
Do we have a hard drive out?
Yes.
Teacher Thalia Neuro was once a Girl Scout, too.
Were there opportunities like this for you when you were their age?
Not that I know of.
She went on to have a more than 2-decade career at Intel. Now she works with a nonprofit that recycles and rebuilds computers.
As a female, you have to really be I don't necessarily want to use the word strong, but you really have to be able to get in there and make your point and make sure that you know what you know.
The reality is the ratio of women in the computer science field has gone down since it peaked in the 80s. The National Center for Education Statistics estimates women earn 18% of computer science undergrad degrees.
Technology jobs have grown significantly, and as a percentage, the number of women have gone down on the whole.
Charles Eaton works at the Computing Technology Industry Association and runs a charity focused on increasing women and minorities in IT. The group's research shows even though today's girls are digital natives, they're less likely than boys to consider a career in in tech. Girls say they don't know of the opportunities.
They need to see it everywhere. It can't just sort of be an isolated event in their lives. You know, when they go back to school, they need to be supported in their studies.
Girl Scout Camp Director Crystal Dingott says the summer camps are one way to boost young women's exposure to science.
Girl Scouts has been fighting that battle for the last 105 years, and this is no different.
If girls push past the stereotypes about who should be in computer science, they're likely to be one of few females in classes and at work. Even women at the top of their field say walking into a room when you're in the minority is awkward at best. Dingott says that's why the all-female environment of camp is so important.
There are no expectations set on them for how they're supposed to dress, how they're supposed to talk, how they're supposed to behave. They're able to be free to just be themselves.
And the girls at this camp are still very much in the process of figuring out what they want to be. Ella Hoffman says she's excited to learn how to build robots later in the week.
It's really fun to do it, and you could get a career out of it.
Chloe Flood, the one with the juice-spilling brother, thinks the computer boot camp could set her on a path toward engineering, or something like it.
It's going to completely change by the time we can get a job. Like flying cars everywhere!
Maybe not everywhere, but the change part is real. That's one reason advocates say the sciences, no matter what discipline, have another benefit. They teach kids how to solve problems and think analytically. Skills that adapt to an uncertain future. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Tempe.
Now let's look at developments in education. Here's the show's Steve Goldstein.
Years after Governor Ducey cut $99 million from Arizona University budgets in 2015, the ripple effects are still being felt. As Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting called it in a recent report, deferred maintenance on the University of Arizona's campus is turning out to be, quote, a time bomb, and it doesn't seem to be the one the state will be able to defuse soon. To talk more about this, we're joined by Jim Small, Executive Director of AZCIR. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So how far in the red is the UA campus?
Yeah, University of Arizona is particularly kind of behind the eight ball when it comes to this, what's called deferred maintenance, which is basically, you know, the regular maintenance of buildings and infrastructure that the school has identified that needs to be done, but that it just frankly has not had the money to do. They are about $200 million. Excuse me, sorry. Their total project right now, they look at $312 million for deferred maintenance. A decade ago, it was only $61 million, which you know, it's kind of one of those things where it snowballs. You know, if you don't, it's kind of like if you don't take care of your car, you don't change your oils, you don't change your tires, you don't take it in for regular service, before long those kinds of small bills add up to really big bills, and then you start looking at, instead of just doing, you know, something small to maintain the system and keep it working properly, you start looking at major overhauls, if not outright replacements. And then that's really kind of where U of A is at right now.
Right. So give us an idea of how bad this really is. Like, when you say maintenance, it doesn't sound like that dire, but there's a hospital on the campus, for example, right?
Yeah, there is. And so last summer, and almost a year ago, it was in July of 2016, they had to evacuate everyone from the hospital because the power went out. And suddenly there was no air conditioning. There was no, you know, just all of those things that you need to run a hospital that run on power. They weren't there. So they had to actually get people out of that hospital for safety reasons. And the reason was not because the hospital itself had a problem, but because a building next door that has a power system from the 1950s, that power system overloaded. Those two systems were connected, and it basically triggered a catastrophic failure in the hospital system. So those are the kinds of things that we're talking about. And you know, our reporters spoke with did a lot of research into it and really looked at the systems that they have in place down there, and they have these air conditioning systems, these electrical systems that date back to the 50s and 60s that are still being used today, that are several generations out of date. And one of the maintenance supervisors she spoke with said, you know, the only way that they can get some of these parts is literally to go onto eBay and look to see if they can find these antique, you know, fuses and, you know, some of these things that have been out of circulation for decades. See if they can find them that way in order to actually keep the university systems running properly.
Jim, you covered the state capitol for a number of years, and one of the most contentious aspects of this last legislative session was this $1 billion bonding package as far as universities are concerned. Is some of that money intended to go for maintenance? And if not, why isn't that a greater priority for lawmakers?
Well, that money is, in fact, slotted for both maintenance and for kind of research and technology, improving research and technology infrastructure. And so each of the schools is going to get, basically what it worked out to was about $27 million a year beginning next year for the next 25 years is going to be given to the universities. And they have to match that money with their own money out of their budgets. So the schools will basically have $54 million every year plus inflation as this thing goes on, and they'll be able to bond against it and borrow against it and be able to get some really large projects done. Each school has its own budget for how it anticipates spending this. For U of A, the reality is because they're so far behind in their critical deferred maintenance that almost half of that money, about $200 million of it, is going to be going specifically for repairing and replacing a lot of these really old systems that are kind of holding the campus back and are potentially health and safety issues.
And Jim, very briefly, what needs to happen next, let's say in the very short term, that can do anything?
Well, you know, I think that for the universities, really this bonding proposal that they got through in the budget was, I think, the thing that they were looking at. This was the most important thing for them. All of the schools have this maintenance problems that they need to take care of. It's larger at U of A, but ASU has $30 million of it. NAU has significantly less, about $3.5 million of it that they've identified to deal with this bonding proposal. But that was really... It's the vehicle that the schools identified as the best way to pay for it without having to go to lawmakers and say, hey, guess what? We actually need you to give us $1 billion or $800 million in order to fix these things.
Okay, great. Jim Small, Executive Director of the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. Jim, thanks.
My pleasure.
And finally this week in business news, CIA Director Mike Pompeo and Director of Homeland Security John Kelly met with Mexico's president this week. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia reports.
The U.S.'s top two security officials met with President Enrique Peña Nieto to discuss how to handle transnational organized crime. They were also joined by Arkansas Republican Tom Cotton, who sits on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. According to a statement from the Mexican president's office, Peña Nieto emphasized his government's willingness to collaborate on fighting organized crime with the goal of keeping the region safe. The visit comes as Mexico is seeing some of its bloodiest months since the country began a war against drug traffickers a decade ago. Government statistics say more than 11,000 people were murdered here during the first 5 months of the year. Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.